Hello everyone, my name is Colin Lambert, I'm Managing Editor of Profit and Loss Magazine, and welcome to the FX panel at Sibos this year. We are that red-headed stepchild that they, well, at least we're not on the last afternoon, I suppose, when everyone's in the pub. But what we're going to be talking about today is a very important development in foreign exchange over the last couple of years, the FX Global Code. We'll go into some of the reasons why we need it and so on. Just to remind everyone that Slido is in operation, so please make sure you've got the app open on your phone, or you can do it on the Slido website. The address is right there on your screens. If you want to ask a question at any time, the one is a modern technology. I've just been listening to quantum computing upstairs. This is probably slightly short of that, but we can see the question on the iPad, and as long as it's not libelous or slanderous, we'll ask it. And we're an FX panel, so guess what? We might even ask the libelous and slanderous ones. I also have the latest toy. This is a microphone, so if you want to ask, do it the old-fashioned way and put your hand up and ask a question, we'll throw you the microphone, or we do have people walking around who can actually hand you a conventional microphone. Obviously, if you're spending too much time on your phone, I did used to play cricket at quite a high level. So, with me is Guy de Bell, Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. If I was going to insult Guy, I could call him the grandfather of the code. Because Guy had chaired the committee that developed the FX Global Code and brought it to fruition before stepping down this time last year, or just 18 months ago, something like that. Yeah. And Fred DiCoccio from Bank of New York Mellon. And Fred is more in the world, I suspect some of you guys are in correspondent banking. He's club head of Treasury Services at Bank of New York Mellon. And we're basically going to look at the top level themes of the code, and then try and look at some of the impact on not only correspondent banking, but actually your service providers, you know, the fintech guys and the programmers and coders. So I think what we'll do, we'll set the scene, Guy. Why was the code needed and how was it created?
Well, the reason why it was needed was the FX industry had a bit of an issue, which had surfaced I suppose 5-6 years ago now, maybe, something like that. Where, so initially around the fix, the London 4pm fix, and then more generally around any number of ways of mostly banks mistreating their customers. Mm-hmm. So there was a, it was suffering a large reputational issue, which was actually had got to the point. So those issues had surfaced, there'd been prosecutions on the back of them, particularly around the fix, and that started to have a detrimental impact on market functioning, which was very evident. And something needed to be done to try and improve that market functioning and redress the reputational issues that the industry was suffering from. We, as central banks, could see that firsthand because we were in the market every day ourselves and could... It was very obvious to see that increased dysfunction in the market. Plus, we care about the exchange rate, which is an important part of monetary policy transmission. So the code was needed to, for a number of reasons. One, to address that reputational issue. You wouldn't just do it for that. The other one was that there were some areas where there was just no common understanding as to what constituted good practice. So you could say that practice needed to improve, but it was useful... we thought it extremely useful to get out there something which actually said this is what we think constitutes good practice so that there'd be an agreed standard on that. There had been codes of conduct in all of the major FX centres for a number of years. Clearly they hadn't been followed. And so we needed to come up with a way also of getting people to follow it, and also the fact that the market is a global market rather than more than almost any other market. Very much pushed for the idea of a global standard rather than one which is particular to each jurisdiction. So, hence, we have one code to rule them all, which is this thing. Mostly it exists in electronic form. It's one of the few hard copies around.
If you can find an unsigned one of those, it's worth a fortune.
Yeah, but the but there is, but it's the important point is it's one for the whole global FX market.
And I guess then it's the question of the fact that this is foreign exchanges. I mean, foreign exchange historically has been a self-regulated market, and this is actually its attempt to avoid becoming an overly regulated market?
Yeah, I was balked slightly at the self-regulated bit in the sense that most of the participating institutions in the FX market, not all, but most, are regulated in some form or another. To some extent, that was why they were able to end up be fined so much, because there was some degree of regulation over them. So there is some, but not particularly on FX business. So they're regulated entities participating in the market which had less regulation than others. That's true. And I think the other point from my side of things is, I mean, the FX market is not an exchange-traded market. And I think there was a serious risk of exchange-type regulation being foisted on it in a way which would absolutely have been to the detriment of market functioning. And so I think it was at least in part an attempt to say this is an appropriate way to regulate, without, this is not regulation, but impose appropriate standards of conduct and behaviour on the market without turning it into an exchange-traded market.
Give people a framework within which they can actually act with a degree of confidence.
Yeah.
So I guess, how do you summarise the key tenets of the code? I mean, there's six basic principles behind it, isn't there? I mean, can you outline those for everybody?
So, I mean, most of the stuff, I think, is common sense, which it's true of nearly all codes of conduct. So I wouldn't describe it as much as so it's more it is a bit more than common sense. As I said, there are some areas where there's where there were grey areas. People had different views, and we try to come up with something which everyone could agree on what constituted good practice. On that, one important point which is worth making is this is not so. While most of the malpractice, at least to date, that we know about was on the sell side. This is not a code of conduct for the sell side, and nor was it developed by the sell side. This code of conduct was developed, we as central banks worked directly on it, but alongside us it was a joint public-private exercise. On the private side, there was the sell side, but there was also buy-side, platforms, corporates, so right across the full spectrum of the market. So it is something which we were able to get agreement on across all segments of the market. So it wasn't, you know, the sell side stuffed up, they're going to write the code of conduct to say how they should behave. No, that wasn't the way it was. As I said, just going back to what it is, it's 55 principles. They're all written in pretty straightforward English. So they're easily understood, both by your average FX trader, which is a fairly low bar, and
thank you,
and obviously also by people from the back office, which is a much higher, you know, which is so it's understandable, I think, from people who, regardless of your degree of participation in the market, I think it should be fairly understandable. The other thing which the code has is, in addition to those principles, which I've a large chunk of which I would say constitute common sense. And in one part of that common sense is actually treat your counterparty well rather than rip them off. That's a theme which underpins a lot of it. But the other point, the other thing we've done is we've put a bunch of examples in there to actually illustrate what we mean by a number of the principles. So it's practical examples. So if you're in this situation, what do you do?
Fred, I mean, what's your observation on embedding principles into a business?
Yeah, thanks, Colin. And I don't know if I need to preface my answer by saying I'm not an FX trader. So
your intelligent answer would also make sure people know that, yeah?
So, I mean, it's critically important. I couldn't agree more with the comments that Guy alluded to. I think, you know, none of us in the room are ignorant to the headlines that have impacted the banking segment over the last few years, whether it's not only in the FX markets, whether it's interest rate manipulation, whether it's mortgage lending. So, you know, instilling standards to ensure the integrity and confidence, the integrity of the market, the confidence of the participants, I think is absolutely critical. What we have done, to some of the other points that Guy had raised, we focused on mitigating market manipulation risk in our processes, in our FX operation. to the point where we have required training with our staff, our FX traders and back office staff, including attestation of the code, as well as acceptable pre-hedging practices, just as an example of how serious we're taking it and the importance that we see of the code to the market.
And I guess it's also important, guys, to sort of say this is a work in progress.
Yeah.
You know, I remember you when you launched it, you said you want this to be a living, breathing document.
Yeah.
And there's still work ongoing now, different work streams.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the streams are very technical, but others are just generally around level of disclosures and things like that, and doing the right thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of things on that. One, the FX industry is in constant change. So something which is relevant 2 years ago now when we first put this out is some parts of that have moved on since then. The structure of the industry has changed, it continues to change. So we've got to make sure that it remains current to that so that, but at the same time, we can't be rewriting the thing holus bolus every couple of years. That's going to defeat the purpose too. So it is evolutionary, as you said, and there are particular issues which are sort of hot button issues in the market at particular times. And the global FXE goes out and seeks market views on that and then distills that and embeds that in the code. So the first example of that was around last look, which was and still is a pretty contentious issue in the industry. So it's to try and distill that down to something which is meaningful, but something which is acceptable to the bulk of market participants. I suppose one thing which I think is important, people often say, well, codes of conduct are not much worth much more than the paper they're written on, or even if they're in electronic form, they've got no paper they're written on, so they're worthless. But the it's important. This comes from something you just said, is that it's important to make sure that it's not just lips. People don't just pay lip yeah. service to it, and there are a number of mechanisms by which that's achieved. One is that businesses actually have to sign up, attest to the code. It's a fairly straightforward attestation. Sorry, the signing of that is straightforward.
Yeah.
What that does mean is you have to be able to demonstrate, if asked by either your counterparty or by your local regulator, what are the processes you've put in place which are consistent with the code. So there is a fair amount of market discipline, I think, and one of the things which, one of the potentially good consequences that came from all the scandals is that I would say that there had been not a lot of market discipline prior to that. FX for some of the larger participants in the market, particularly on the buy side, was more a secondary business. And so if nothing else, the prevalence of those scandals and the consequences of them brought it a lot more front and center and gave it a lot more visibility. So there is more market discipline. The other thing also in a number of jurisdictions, including the one here and also in the UK, is that the local securities regulators use that as part of their market oversight. In the FCA, it's part of the senior managers regime. Here, ASIC uses it as its sort of reference point in terms of its oversight of the FX market here, and that's true, in, I think, in Hong Kong and Singapore at least as well.
So, Guy, if I can just add to that in terms of, the practicality or adoption of code, in some ways in the U.S., U.S. banks or banks operating in the U.S. had a taste of it, you can argue, with the introduction of the Dodd-Frank Act years ago after the financial crisis. At that time, it was not specific to FX. It was really more around disclosure, ensuring that you're properly disclosing rate to consumers of payment services. But to Guy's point around balancing the acceptance of the code, one thing I think we learned from that is, you get to a point of diminishing return on a regulation being too heavy-handed, and then starting to have to peel back the layers of the onion to find a balance where the industry is going to.
Which is exactly what they're doing at the moment with Dodd-Frank.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. We're going to wake you guys up now because I think we've got a Slido question ready to go, so you can get the app open and or get on the website. Guy mentioned a statement of commitment there, so here's a question for you. You'll have about 12 seconds to vote on it, I believe, and there'll be some very dramatic music while people do. Should your institution commit to the FX Global Code? And We thought we'd make it trickier than yesterday. I saw yesterday everything was three answers. We'll give you five to have a think about. But yeah, if you're ready to go, please vote.
I can add one to the top bar because we've issued a statement of commitment, but I don't have to.
I mean, I guess the interesting thing for me from that is that I guess, yeah, there's you'd question, I guess, the 6% no until it becomes mandatory.
Mm.
But the plans to in the future, I mean, how do we sort of get people, how do we continue the outreach of the code?
By events like this, in all honesty. So I think it's interesting in the global FXC, which has sort of oversight of all of this, which is both central banks and the private sector, the FX industry, has been trying to monitor how much outreach they get. And I would say on the sell side, the outreach is pretty much total, near enough.
Yeah.
Or about as far as much as you would expect. On the platform side, again, I would say it's large. On the buy side, I think is where it's particularly mixed. And some of it is some combination of don't know and know we do little FX business.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one's sort of fine in the sense that one of the things we go to great pains to stress in the code is it's the concept of proportionality. So not all, if you're a buy-side firm who doesn't transact directly in the market, a lot of the stuff's not going to be relevant for you. If you're involved in another part of, if you're purely in the settlements business, well, only the settlements part of the business is going to be relevant for you. And the rest of it is just there as much for your information. And one thing I've particularly tried to stress when talking to the corporates about it is sort of, you know, it's not, if you've only got reasonably irregular or indirect interaction with the market, what I think the code is most useful for is what is a standard behavior you should be expecting from whoever's doing your FX execution for you. I wouldn't expect you to sign the code.
Yeah.
If, on the other hand, you're a large buy-side firm and you've got your own FX trading desk, I don't see my expectation on you is no different than it is on around a sell-side bank, in that it's... So it's very much dependent on the degree of your participation in the market. But if you are, as I said, more of a on the receiving end, then I think it's very much a question of giving you an idea about how you should expect to be treated in the market. The other thing it does provide you is these are the sort of things you shouldn't ask your counterparty to do on your behalf as well.
So, Guy, can I just add to that? I think, you know, another way of considering adoption of the code or... In, I don't want to say enforcement of the code, but enforcement of the code is, you know, what we expect our counterparties. We responded to the GFX survey saying we expect our counterparties to sign the code. We have not made it compulsory, and we are starting to deal with counterparties on a case-by-case basis that have not signed. You know, whether we make it compulsory or whether all institutions make it compulsory, I guess, to be determined, but it's clearly, you know, another consideration of how the market wants to force, or the industry wants to force the market to adopt, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think an interesting question around that is actually in terms of the platforms. If you've got platforms, a number of them are signed up to the code, if you've got people operating on your platform who you're not confident on their behavior, that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
Well, because a lot of the platforms hide behind the fact we've got platform rules.
Yeah.
But those platform, I mean, have they actually checked whether their platform rules actually do adhere to the guidelines in the global code?
Yeah.
I guess it's, you know, to Guy's point about proportionality, you work your way through your business, working out exactly which of these principles relates to your business.
Absolutely.
I believe it's going to be broadcast tomorrow morning. It's clearly going to be the highlight of Cybos, but I did a TV interview earlier today, and I've got Keith Sedergreen, who I'm going to throw things out now. This is where it gets dangerous. Keith, can you give us a few thoughts, as we did lunchtime, on talking to the X, in terms of, you know, the outreach program, how you think it works, and also what we can do to keep the momentum for the code up?
Well, I think Fred made a good point there, where it's top down, really. It's the banks that have signed to the code. That basically the waterfall effect, where they only deal with people that have signed the statement of commitment. Okay, on a case by case basis, but why haven't you signed it when you know it's to your benefit with all the transparency that goes with it? And there again, it goes down to the next level where maybe people dealing with any sort of service provider asks about their statement of commitment and have they signed it? Do they know about the FX Global Code? Because I think the transparency aspect can add to the bottom line because the service is going to be that much better.
So you see more people asking more questions about it?
Yeah.
I guess the challenge is what happens if they don't like the answer? What do we do then? Mm. I know, Fred, for instance, if somebody turns around to you and says, like, no, we actually haven't signed the Global Code of Conduct because we don't feel we need to. Yeah.
Well, I think there are a lot of other, you know, parts to that question that have to be considered. Certainly, you know, for banks, relationships with that counterparty, the level of business we're doing with that counterparty beyond FX, how disruptive do we want to be to that relationship in enforcing the code if there is a relatively high degree, based on past experience, of them conducting themselves properly in trading with us. But I think, I don't know if I have an absolute answer to that question, but no. I think it's something to take away for consideration how to do that.
Because, I mean, the central banks did say when the code was first launched that they wouldn't transact with non-signatories except for in certain circumstances.
Is
that a get-out-of-jail-free card for a central bank? Or is that
we don't transact with... So now we do require all our counterparties to have signed the code. Mm. So the get-out-of-jail card is... this is nothing which is likely to happen in the foreseeable future in Australia. But if we're in the world of FX intervention... So we did, 10 years ago, when the last time we were intervening in the FX market... We're not going to stop in the middle of FX intervention and say, we're not sure if this person who just hit us has signed the code and, not go through with the transaction. So that's the get out, is in those sort of circumstances where we've got other considerations at top of mind. We're not going to be busy verifying that every person on the other side of the market has signed the code. But in our regular business, so as of today... All of our counterparties have signed up to the code, and we won't deal with ones who haven't.
Okay. Just want to go back to you, Keith. Guy mentioned corporates. You raised an interesting point with me the other day about how corporates, why it's important that corporates sign the code in terms of their operations and their governance.
Well, I just think again, it's down to transparency and the way they're treated. I mean, Guy mentioned it earlier. It's the way that they're treated. Maybe they might look at FX as more transparent and clear, and it'll help their bottom line because they know what to expect from their service provider and or bank. Mm. So I think a greater understanding at that corporate treasurer's level should help the market as well.
So it's all about getting the word out there.
Mm.
From your perspective, Fred, has there actually been any discernible impact on the code for someone in the correspondent banking world at this moment?
I would say not directly. Again, from the correspondent banking perspective, and I guess how I would define correspondent banking for the purpose of this discussion is really, the FX trade to cross-border payments or commercial payments. And, from our perspective, they remain really two separate and distinct activities. On the one hand, when we're providing payment services to a client that they want to make U.S. dollars cross-border to another destination, they're obviously interested in just getting a good rate. But the settlement of that is separate and distinct of then what we have to do, what our markets team has to do to actually cover that position at our various Nostro accounts. So, from that perspective, I would have to argue that there has not been a direct impact to the correspondent banking business. The two things I would point out, I think, that maybe for consideration is there have been an adoption of some FX payment practices over the last few years around so-called auto conversion or selecting a preferred correspondent to convert on your behalf without an implicit instruction from the ordering customer. And, you know, in my opinion, you know, the code talks to that type of practice and whether it is something that the industry should, you know, either put into a code or a policy or govern in a different way.
We've actually got a couple of questions from the floor while we're on the adherence piece. I guess we'll go to you, Guy, on this. Who will be the judge if you ignore the code that you've committed to? What types of incentives and monitoring for institutions to attest to the code, you know, are out there or available? Yep.
So on the first one, I don't know who the judge was who heard the cases around the fix, but that would be the judge. I mean, I say that in jest, but also in all seriousness, it's like, good luck with your defence if in 10 years' time it turns out you've been said, yeah, we knew the code was out there, we just chose to ignore it. It's like, well, I can see that going down well in a court of law, given how, and particularly with the precedent, which is already out there. So to some extent, the answer to that question is that that's the judge. So there actually might literally be a real judge. And history, recent history would suggest there's some chance of that that happening. To the extent ignorance was used as a defence in some of those cases, that's, I suppose, to the point, yeah. It is not a defence anymore. It will be willful neglect this time around, which I think is probably going to put you in an even worse place than ignorance to the extent that was true even in the first place. Yeah. The other judge, I think, I made this point a few times, including, I think, in conversations with you, is that the other judge, to some extent at the moment, now more plausibly, is your customer or your counterparty.
Absolutely.
So painting too dark a picture of the way the industry used to be, if you were getting ripped off by one counterparty going back a few years and you said, I'm going to take my business down the road to someone else, that wasn't really a particularly credible threat because there's a fair chance you're going to get ripped off to pretty much the same degree by them. Whereas now, I think that is a credible threat. You can say, well, if you're not going to treat me well, I'll take my business to someone who will. And I think there is actually a more plausible... So that, to some extent, is the other judge. Around the adherence to the code, so we can't use the word enforceability because it's not, as Mr. Potter would, if he were here, would remind us, it is not regulation. And we would have said that at least 10 times by now. And it isn't. But I mentioned a couple of things earlier, and it depends on the jurisdiction you're in. But in this jurisdiction, ASIC is using it in its surveillance of FX market activities, which they're sort of out and about conducting right at the moment. In the UK, the FCA has recognised it effectively as part of the senior managers regime. So that gives a fair amount of oomph behind it. The other... as I mentioned earlier, that the central banks will only deal with people who have signed up to the code. And I'm not kidding myself as to the value of our FX business because it's not that large. But there is some reputational effect if we threw you off our counterparty panel because you wouldn't sign up to the code.
And it would be a different matter, with all due respect to the RBA or due disrespect, whichever way people are going to take this, it would be a different matter if it was BlackRock saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Some of them deal with billions of dollars.
So I do think that some part of it comes from the way the market takes it as well. And I said one thing which I think would be particularly interesting would be if the platforms headed down that route, because that would actually give it quite a bit of oomph. Just on the visibility on that, and I know it's not necessarily exactly as good as it can be, but so the information as to who signed up to the code is out there. So if you go to the Global FXE site, there's a page which has got registries on it, and from there you can see who has signed up to the code on the various registries which are out there.
Do you think we need more detail around that? Because, I mean, for instance, I don't even know if you know the answer to this, Fred, but, you know, Bank of New York Mellon are a signatory to the Global Code.
Right.
Does that actually cover the correspondent banking business or the payments business? Or is it an umbrella signatory? Because I know a lot of the institutions have signed up for their FX and local markets business.
I would say we signed it only in the context of our FX trading business. again, we know with our focus, particularly on trying to mitigate manipulation risk, enforcing, you know, standards and practices amongst the FX staff. So I would say it does not blanket over to the payment business.
So that varies institution by institution.
Right.
There are some, I may get this wrong, but I think it's true. I think Citi basically assigned on behalf of their whole global business.
I'm not sure about their PB.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it does vary institution by institution, and it does generally make it clear what part of the business is actually covering, mostly because it's got someone's name there with their title on it.
So our attestation is global in nature in terms of all of our trading desks globally, but it is limited to our markets activity, not to our payments.
So does your interaction now then become a situation whereby you need to understand the code and its impact on the FX business so that you can actually monitor the service you're getting from your internal providers?
I would say absolutely yes. Again, because we rely on those internal both internal service providers and correspondent banks that we select to be the last leg of a payment transaction for us are critically important to the quality of service we deliver to our clients. So in that respect, we do need to be involved, and we do need to be understand the implications thereof. Certainly, you know, are all 55 tenets of the code, you know, relevant? Absolutely not. But, you know, things around pricing disclosures, you know, avoiding things around, you know, last look to manipulate price, things of that nature are the ones that would rise to the top for us in the payment space.
So I guess there's like 54% of you hadn't signed a statement of commitment. Maybe at least read the code, and then you might start asking questions of the people in your FX business. It might make for a few tricky conversations. I wanted to sort of cover something that, you know, this conference, the fourth floor in particular, is there's a lot of fintech out there. There's a lot of innovative ideas. I mean, how does the code treat innovation? You know, it's because, as you said, the industry is always, the foreign exchange market is always evolving. Technology is evolving faster. I would actually argue one of the reasons why we needed the code was because literally the technology outstripped our ability to actually surveil what traders were doing. How does the code approach the sort of the technology world?
Well, you certainly acknowledge that it exists, so that's a start.
A few years ago wouldn't have been true.
So there's a section there on algos, you know. The always useful phrase, don't you let your algo loose on the market if you don't know what it's actually going to do to it. So, you know, try to avoid disruptive algos, but also, you know, but have appropriate risk management around that, including, you know, appropriate kill switches, for example. So you'll be able to be confident. So it's very much in the sort of risk management space in terms of being able to manage your technology so that it is not having a disruptive impact on the market. It doesn't go down the route of of the SEC in, you know, provide your algo for a clean bill of health before you use it. It's not that. As I said, this is about principles, not about regulation. But it is very much about, you should be able to demonstrate the sort of, you know, testing or whatever that you've done around your algos before you're letting them loose out there. But also, I mean, you know, Chris sitting here with one of the largest non-bank providers around these days, which again wouldn't have been something we would have been concerned about even a decade ago, really. And but that's, you know, that's a technology business. I think that's fair to say. You know, and most of the sell side, FX is really a technology business these days. Not many people left in FX these days. It's mostly machines.
Coding the machines.
Yeah, or for better or worse. And so the code's got to very much acknowledge that. It's not necessarily about someone picking up the phone and doing the deal with the counterparty. It's sort of the platform on which you're executing, the sort of validity of the price. You know, last look is not a technology issue. It's not a people issue fundamentally.
On the subject of algos, I mean, the first place I'd want to go to get my algo checked is a government agency. That'd be perfect. Chris, so Chris Knight works for XTX Markets. This guy said he's one of the biggest non-bank players that, you know, frankly, 5 years ago, most people would not have actually heard of. What do you see the challenges around the regulation, or sorry, the code, and making sure that the people actually developing the algos and the coders and the programmers?
Yeah, that's right. I don't consider it just about the algos. We, you know, all the principles still apply to XTX. We need to treat our clients fairly via software. We don't have any traders. It's 100% electronic firm.
So a trading firm with no traders.
Trading firm with no traders.
That is the modern world, ladies and gentlemen.
And 105 staff. So, our software needs to treat clients fairly, transparently, and follow the same principles that a traditional bank with manual traders would need to follow. So that comes through software audits, proper governance, all the same sort of similar sort of controls as a voice business. In one way, it's almost not different, except it can be very, very fast. You know, software can steal money from somebody without them even seeing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's super quick. So you need those audits of software in place. And I would say here for the people that haven't signed the code, and I know it's more than 50%, if you work for a technology company that provides execution software or settlements of confirmation, the code does apply to you, and unless you've written the code, a developer might have inadvertently written a line that doesn't treat your client fairly. So you do need controls in place. On top of those sorts of software audits, we also have independent software for market surveillance that will, observe to make sure we're following the global code and ECN and exchange rules.
So let me ask you a question then. If you see something happen on a public, to Guy's point about, you know, the platform was watching what's going on, if you see something on a public platform that you don't like or you're suspicious of, is that something you now, as a matter of routine, escalate to the platform?
Yes, we do, yeah. So interesting, when I started 2.5 years ago, I was in London and, you know, all the developers or quants were freaking out about something happening in Russia, and it was quite a small spoof, you know, $20 million. And I was wondering why they're getting so excited about it.
Just the $20 million bucks.
$20 million of volume, not of, of theft. And their view was that they were excited because it was a new type of spoof that they hadn't seen before. But their view was that if they didn't report it, that somebody was just testing something out and they'd industrialise it if they got away with it. So, we take it as our duty to report these things.
I think one thing is, which is basically I think what Chris is saying, is I would say the code is pretty much technology agnostic. So it doesn't matter. I mean, as you say, it's mostly a question of speed, but the fundamental principle doesn't matter too much whether it's a person doing it or it's a human, it's a machine doing it. It's just effectively one of speed. The principle at the heart of it is still pretty much the same.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that, Colin, that, you know, my opinion, to Guy's point, you know, fintech is an enabler, facilitator of a transaction. It really doesn't change the underlying practice of, you know, FX trading or payment. So,
yeah, I accept that. I guess it comes down to this. There's a culture of challenge,
yep,
to my view, in the code. If you see something, say something.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I think it's, to me, I look at it and think, you know, if you want to sort of know how serious this gets, there's one FX trader been sentenced to 2 years jail in the US who actually lives in the UK. That's a culture shock to him. There's three FX traders currently on trial in New York facing a similar thing. And to the fintech issue, there's a guy called Jitesh Thacker who runs a software company in Chicago. And he actually delivered a piece of software to a trader who became known as the Hound of Hounslow, who spoofed futures markets and made about $40 million. The person that actually provided the technology is now on trial for doing so. So yeah. Is there an obligation there on the part of you as a service taker,
yeah,
to actually turn around and say, well, if there's something wrong here, I've got to escalate, because that guy
absolutely, yeah,
will be complicit in that.
In that regard, I would have to agree with you wholeheartedly. Yeah, absolutely.
So the fintechs out there need to think, because it's a question of responsibility, isn't it, Guy? I mean, there's a question actually on here. Someone said, is the signature on behalf of a company or an individual?
So that was a question we... So there's someone's name on it.
Yeah.
But it's name, company.
Yeah. So they sign on behalf of the company.
But one of the things is the accountability goes up. So there's someone's name on it, but the accountability, always keeping in mind the concept of proportionality, but if your fundamental business is an FX business, one of the things we say is, so there's someone's name on it, but the accountability goes right through the executive of the company.
Yeah.
And again, if you're coming, at least in the UK, with the senior managers regime, the accountability is very why I hesitate, because there at least the accountability is both individual and corporate.
Yeah,
it's not one or other.
Is there a problem though, Chris, that you actually need to make sure? I mean, to Guy's point, yes, the responsibility goes upwards, but you've actually got to make sure the responsibility goes downwards, so that the coders, the guys programming, actually understand what they can and cannot do under the global code.
Yeah, I'd say not too dissimilar. I don't know how far actually that an e-learning process or something would go to at a bank, but we've only got 105 staff, and I'm pretty sure all of them would have had to do some e-learning on the code, which includes those developers. Honestly, it's really easy to inadvertently write some code that can treat clients incorrectly.
Yeah, and is there a problem then, Fred, that actually then you're buying some software from a fintech firm, you've got to make sure that the people who are going to assess that software
absolutely
are aware of what their responsibilities are.
So that gets into a whole other aspect of vendor management, vendor risk management from our perspective, right? So we're ensuring that we're doing the right due diligence, to ensure that we know what we're buying. And not only before the fact, after we implement, putting the right risk and governance controls to monitor throughout the process on that platform.
So to the point, principle 5, as many to find it, is very much about going down as well. The signatory of the code have got to be able to demonstrate that you have been able to, for those people in your business who have that interaction with the market, of the FX market, that they're fully aware and understand the FX code. Either by, as Chris said, some sort of e-learning facility, which, for our friends in ACI or the like, or whatever. But, you've got to be able to demonstrate that it's understood down through the organisation, at least in the parts which have that interaction with the market.
And for whatever attestation is worth, in terms of ensuring that staff do that, we adopted that practice of not only educating the staff on the code, but having them attest that they understand the code.
And continue attestation.
And then continuing, following up attestation. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the RBA is an annual process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I guess that's the thing, to your point earlier, technology moves on. I mean, quite a few people in this room might be familiar with the issues around settlement. We've got CLS, we've had CLS windows. But there is a move out there to sort of try and move some of this stuff onto distributed ledger technology using tokens. There's guys talking to me about atomic settlement and so on. It all sounds very sexy. I think basically it does the same thing. So is part of your challenge going forward then, Fred, actually keeping up with these new technologies as they come in and trying to actually marry them to?
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to our FX operations because I'm not part of that, but just firm-wide, things like distributed ledger technology, blockchain, adoption of, cryptocurrency, where it may be applicable, is all incredibly relevant for us.
Mm.
How much of it we're actually adopting and employing at the end of the day, still a big question mark. But, you have to stay up with the times, as they say, right?
There's enough people out there to insist on telling me that blockchain is a solution looking for a problem.
Yeah.
Actually, I think what we'll do, we're actually going to Slido 2, if we may please everyone, so we can have more dramatic music. I think it's around DLT, but if you want it, you can actually sort of listen, here's one for the settlement people in the room. I'm not sure I know the answer for me. Vote away, people, please.
don't know should be the, oh, well, okay. I'm surprised.
So we have some technology evangelists in the room. That's nice to see. We're still moving. I mean, I guess the good news from that, though, is that the people are very comfortable. If we broaden that out to technology generally, if people are very comfortable with adopting fintech, then they must hopefully be comfortable that they can align it with the principles of something like the Global Code.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the settlement one is interesting. I mean, I think, I don't think that the technology actually matters that much in terms of what for settlement almost more than anything else, actually. I think, what are you trying to achieve with settlement?
Yeah.
The general principle remains the same regardless of the technology pretty much actually used to do the settlement.
Yeah.
So I think that's almost easier than some other aspects. I mean, if you think about more on the front office side, on the execution side, the issues around flash crashes, including the one the Sterling one that happened, that's a slightly more, there was a discernible difference between that being done by a machine, I think, and that one being and what you could have achieved as a human in that time frame. Slow speed matters in stuff like that in a way which is not quite so much of an issue with settlement.
Do you think it will be helpful, to explain to people, there are several registers where people need to put their statement of commitment to the Global Code. Do you think actually it would be, for instance, one I heard of relatively recently was the European Association of Corporate Treasurers.
Yep.
Have a register just for corporate treasuries. Do you think it would actually be helpful for the industry if we actually developed a register for technology providers, like a fintech register that could then be built into the main?
Potentially. That's fine. I mean, part of the point was we were fairly agnostic on that, on who should provide registries, and there are quite a different variants on that. CLS has one, for instance.
Yeah.
And in this in Australia, AFMA runs it here. And part of the point about having the GFXC didn't want to get into the business of registry provision as much as we just weren't quite sure we had the resources to be able to do it, and others did. But it does at least provide a registry of registries, so that it at least provides a one-stop shop, which, and I think it's searchable, where you can actually go to up to a point, well, supposed to be at some point, where you can go and go from there. And if there's a sorting mechanism by sort of part of the industry, that's probably helpful for people.
So same question, I guess, on correspondent banking and people in the payments business. Given Guy's point about the proportionality, would it be helpful in your world if actually we could say, well, actually, let's have a register for these things, a statement of commitment from correspondent banking and payments divisions, so at least they're aware of the code?
Absolutely. And not to promote our host here, but to me, SWIFT has a network effect in the banking industry for correspondent banks, and I can see them being a platform for a global registry for correspondents in the space. So.
And I guess at some stage, then we ask the question: does SWIFT sign a statement of commitment as part of that thing? I mean, because
if they're going into the FX business,
exactly.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I guess because how does it sit with SWIFT? And as does CLS, they do meet the other standards for critical market infrastructure.
Yeah.
Does that kind of negate the need for them to sign a commitment? Because they are two different things, aren't
they? Yeah. I mean, CLS has signed the code, obviously.
They had to. They had to. Their CEO was deputy chair. Yeah, it was
a bit hard life on it along with me. So, yes. But again, it partly comes to the nature of the of the interaction, but we were keen to get a fair chunk of the core infrastructure of the market signed up, so amongst other things people could have confidence. So again, not much of the code actually applies to CLS, but in the parts which do, people probably really want to know that they can have confidence in that part of the market. Now, yes, they have those other forms of validation through because they are critical market infrastructure. So that gives you other degrees of comfort. But at least looking at it purely through this lens, which is not necessarily the same lens that some of those other regulators would look at it through.
Mm. So I've got a question here, Fred. You're going to have to help me on this one because I don't understand it.
Put me on the spot.
Old spot trader. Should the code cover recommended payment type? I understand that bit. Example being use of MT202 versus MT103s, which I'm now lost on, and crossover lack of consistency with payment anti-money laundering best practices.
So I think another way to ask that question, should the code apply separately to commercial payments versus bank-to-bank settlement?
Okay.
Is really.
Thank you for explaining that to me.
Again, I think it gets back to some of the earlier discussion we had around, the applicability of the code to the payment industry. Again, commercial payments, a sender and receiver of funds cross border, their interest is really, are they getting an appropriate rate? Are they being disclosed of a competitive rate? You know, a lot of the other tenets of the code around settlement and the like is probably secondary. On the the bank-to-bank payment space, that is more applicable to the settlement of FX trades. So if you want to compartmentalize where you want to apply the code, probably more relevant on the 202 space than the MT103 space. But I'm not sure if there's value in really getting that granular in how the code is applied in the correspondent banking space.
Yeah, I mean, the code is very principles-based.
Exactly.
We don't. The other aspects, we certainly wouldn't get into that level.
Yeah.
So again, at a high level, it would be just make sure that you are using the appropriate mechanisms and have the right safeguards around
You should be able to demonstrate that it's fit for purpose.
Yeah. I mean,
that's part of the other
absolutely.
Point. So, and coming back to a question you asked earlier, Colin, about the judge. I mean, one of the things, there's a large amount of stuff in the FX industry which is grey. There's some stuff which is white and there's some stuff which is clearly black, but there's a fair amount of grey.
Yeah.
Part of the point is that you should be able to at least have thought about it ex ante rather than ex post and have a credible explanation as to why you think what you're doing is consistent with the code. I can't guarantee you that someone, 10 years hence, someone will apply some degree of hindsight which will negate that. But the more you can say, this is how we thought about it, and demonstrate, actually, this is how we thought about it, these were the sort of things we were thinking about in applying these principles, it's surely got to help.
It's a foreign exchange panel. We're going to go random now. We've clearly got a few overseas travellers in this room, because the question I've got is, will the code be extended to players like Travelex and the post office who charge 0% commission but add large margins to the FX rates, which they do not disclose? In other words, a bunch of you being ripped off at the airport on your way down here.
Yeah, so one thing we were at great pains to point out, and in part because... So this is about wholesale FX, not retail FX. The code, is about wholesale FX, retail FX. That question's about retail FX.
Yeah.
Although there is actually an inquiry just launched in this country, at least, into
exactly that, yes.
But the code is... And one of the reasons why the code is only about wholesale FX and is explicitly not about retail FX is because the retail regulation in each jurisdiction just around the world varies incredibly.
And that aspect really touches on some parts of the correspondent banking business too, because it is a conduit to settle a lot of retail related payment activity.
So I thought we can't do a panel at Sivos without talking about AI. They both look nervously at me. Chris, he's an old program. He's a trader who's done prey. So I do want to sort of look at it. I mean, and I'll actually promote a panel here. I believe it's tomorrow or maybe Thursday. And it's like ethics in AI. I think it's upstairs at InnoTribe. Might be quite worth listening. But Chris, from your point of view, what challenges does it represent when you've got a machine learning environment? Because you started off as a coder and then let it go. How do we marry that with the principles of the code?
I mean, XTX is built on machine learning and AI, but that's mostly for the research. So a human quant will look at, we're built on correlations across markets. So a quant will receive correlations from our research machine, and it will throw up ideas. It'll still have that human interface to approve them and say it makes sense, that there's something real behind the correlation, and then that will be put into the model as an input. And through that process, there's so many different safeguards. So I wouldn't say, you know, while we're 100% automated, and as Guy pointed out, the Sterling flash crash, I don't personally think it would have happened in a manual trader's world, mm-hmm. not at that speed and you know, 6% or whatever, ever the market moves so quickly, or more, wouldn't have happened. But that's sort of just electronic safeguards, and not really AI.
Yeah.
But you know, I think every event like that does make the world a little bit stronger.
Mm.
You know, where we are, everybody that's good should use those examples in their back testing and what if scenarios, and try and build some safeguards around it. You know, our machine, for instance, in the Sterling flash crash, stopped pricing. It said it couldn't compute, and it was up to a human to come back in and turn it back on.
So to that point, Guy, I mean, is this where we need the code? We need to sort of really get this word out about responsibility. And so if someone is actually developing something in the AI and machine learning space, within the firm, a best practice would be for them to actually put their name on that piece of work, so that we can have some responsibility. Because what worries me is that we sit there and we have a runaway algo, or we have something go wrong, or we have, you know, like the spoofing, people spoofing markets, which is actually illegal in the US. Mm. And someone codes this thing, and like, well, it wasn't me, it was the machine.
No,
yeah, I mean, I started it off here, but the machine just went and learned this.
No, I mean, we're pretty clear on that. It is your if you're putting it into the market, it is your responsibility. There's no two ways.
But does it need an individual responsibility?
Well, you have got the individual response. You know, the head of whatever part of the organization, which is, you know, if it's the e-trading business or whatever, that person who's head of that organisation has absolutely got the personal responsibility. I think that's fairly clear.
Yeah.
So beware what your people are doing.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't know if anyone wants to ask a question the old-fashioned way. We promise not to throw the catch box too hard if you do. So you've been very good on the Slido. So I guess we'll close out then. I mean, I guess it's... firms doing enough to adhere to the code. I think it's, do you expect firms to sort of reinvestigate their adherence to the code on an annual, biannual basis, you know, constant basis? Or do you think that leadership has come from the Global Foreign Exchange Committee by saying, this is what we've identified?
So there's an expectation that you'll reattest each year.
Yeah.
Now, to some extent, it's up to you as to what constitutes that, but again, you've got to be able to demonstrate all those things anytime someone would ask you to be able to demonstrate that, and so again, I would expect that most people would have the relevant staff doing the same, retest, you know, have the training annually, retest each year. Parts, as I said, we said earlier on, the code is a living document, it's going to change. We've got to make sure, you know, as I said, it's not changing in any wholesale fashion, but it will change. There are some issues that we are, which are in a state of flux in the market, some new issues surfacing, and the code will adapt to reflect them. So at the very least, your training would need to stay current with that.
And that, I guess, brings me to my final question to you, Fred, will be this adherence to code and embedding the fintech and surveillance all costs money.
Yep,
is there a danger that we end up in an industry where we have the haves and the have-nots? Oh, it becomes a pure sort of thing.
Well, I think that exists today to a certain extent in the varying degrees of technology budgets that we're all faced with. I mean, it's no secret the cost of regulatory oversight and the imbalance there. Whether we end up there, I guess, to be determined. But I think the code sets a really excellent precedent for the market to follow and for banks that are looking to review or reconsider, their policies and governance and practice in this space. I think it's an excellent starting point.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you know, To the extent that treating your customer well becomes a returns as a central tenet of banking, that is very much, and people regard that as actually a profitable opportunity rather than a cost center, then the code at least is very much consistent with that.
That's a very good, that's a good positive way to end this. My thanks to Guy and to Fred, to Chris and for Keith for joining in. Thanks everyone for listening. Your questions from the floor. Have a nice day.
Great. Thank you very
much. See you later. Thanks, Fred.